Hi, everyone. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Programs podcast, and welcome back to our series where we're talking to our Evoke therapists and learning a little bit about their background and their unique story and what brought them to this point in their career. And today I have on with me a special guest, Ken Gilbert. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks, Brad. Glad to be here.
Really glad to have you. I've known you for a long time, and that really gets into my first question, which is your background. Tell us a little bit about your story and what brought you to this point now as a wilderness therapist here at Evoke.
Sure, of course. Yeah, I think it's a good place to start, and it's fascinating to me just in that I'm sitting here talking to you on one of our podcasts and have this clear image of you and I meeting for session a long time ago when I was actually a wilderness client of this program many years ago. And so it's sort of a surreal moment for us to be in conversation in this setting. But so my story, I think, is a bit of a unique one in some ways and also not in others. But I arrived at this work as a result of my own personal journey and struggles. And, you know, as an adolescent and a young adult, I struggled with mental health and addiction for really a long time up until I came to the wilderness program when I was 25 years old. And, you know, one of the things that for me was really difficult was, you know, I could get sober for a period of time, but I had a really hard time maintaining sobriety. And I had been through a lot of different programs, kind of outpatient programs, residential programs, sober living environments, and it never really stuck. And so my kind of introduction to this work was actually my own personal experience in the program. And the thing that I think was really powerful for me was just recognizing what profound change happened out in the woods when we were able to sort of disconnect to connect, I guess is the way that I would think of it now. You know, you're stripped of sort of the creature comforts and things you become accustomed to and really get to learn how to be in a relationship with just yourself and other people. And I think that was really a different kind of experience for me. So that was my introduction to this as even a thing, a form of a modality of treatment. I remember first being told, you know, you're going to probably go to a wilderness program. And I had no idea what that meant. and honestly, I was quite sort of scared of the proposition of what that means to be outside. I wasn't necessarily an outdoorsy person growing up. So that was kind of my introduction. And I think naturally from there, after, you know, I ended up living in Bend after the program and, you know, had some successes, some ups and downs. Eventually it became sort of a natural progression. You know, wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do moving forward. I had a degree in marketing and advertising. And what I was clear about was I didn't necessarily want to go back to that. I needed something with, you know, my therapist calls it juice, right? Having a little more juice and some purpose, some meaning. And so, you know, one of the things that had come up was possibly being a field instructor. And right. And so I thought that was a really great opportunity to be able to get back into do some kind of different work. And also it gave me the ability to sort of explore what my next move would be afterwards. And so I kind of dove in to the work that way.
Yeah, you've really experienced kind of a full range of changes, and I guess that means eventually you're going to have to take over my job.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah.
So you came back as a field instructor to give that a shot. I know you've had a range of positions here at Evoke since you've come to work with us. Tell us a little bit about your evolution to becoming a primary therapist for a group.
Sure, yeah, of course. So So I became a field staff, and I did that for about a year. And I think one of the things that I noticed during my time as a field instructor was that I gravitated towards the individual work. Kind of, I mean, we would call it in the field like dapsing up, right, with your sort of staff mentor for the week. Mm-hmm. And that was where I felt like there was a lot of energy for me to be able to have one-on-one conversations and process some of the things that were coming up for the clients that we work with, on a minute-to-minute basis sometimes, and how that connects to what their experience was back at home or back in college or wherever they had come from. And also kind of taking a look at what some of those patterns were as it relates to kind of how they were raised and what their childhood was like, and helping build that kind of awareness and not doing it for clients, but just being there on the journey with them. And, you know, there were other parts of the job that I certainly loved too. I definitely became more accustomed to living outside and being outside and finding a great kind of strength there. But I think that individual and group sort of therapeutic work, I felt like, okay, there's something here that, you know, perhaps I certainly enjoy, and perhaps I could sort of develop as a skill and perhaps a career moving forward. And so I think it was at that time, you know, maybe about 6 to 9 months into being a field instructor, that I started having thoughts about, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll become a therapist or a counselor or something to that nature and work more specifically kind of in individual therapy. And so I did that for a year, and then kind of was ready for just a change of pace and starting to think about grad school and things of that nature, started doing my research. There was an opening in the office up here in Bend to become the parent coordinator. And so I took that position, and I was in that position for a fairly short time. But one of the things that drew me to that was having the opportunity to work with the families, and not necessarily in a therapeutic capacity, but in being a kind of a first point of contact, honestly, and knowing from my own personal experience with my family, like what a vulnerable, raw, and oftentimes traumatic time for parents who are enrolling, you know, a child into a wilderness program, and just to, you know, share some space with them, answer their questions. You know, that was, I was drawn to that aspect of that job and being a resource for families when they, you know, were certainly in a time of need. So I did that for several months, and then started applying to graduate school. And at the time, you know, a former therapist, Michael Griffin, who was working, was looking for a clinical assistant. And I think that was kind of the natural next step as I was getting into graduate school, to get a master's in clinical mental health and counseling, to sort of go under his wing, if you will, and work as his assistant. And I did that for about 3 years, and for kind of the entire duration that I was in school as well. So, and what an amazing experience that was to have, you know, as sort of a former therapist, a mentor, and, you know, a coworker, a boss, someone that, you know, really had an amazing impact on my life and my own recovery, and has influenced, you know, my sort of how I am as a therapist and how I show up and what I look for. And so it really was kind of a one of a kind experience for me.
Yeah, that's an amazing opportunity. I think that there's just not enough of that mentoring in our profession, right? You don't get to watch other people's sessions enough. I mean, I wish every therapist really in every setting would have the opportunity to work under a therapist and be able to sit in on sessions for 3 years. What an amazing experience. And Griff, of course, we both know is a very gifted, creative, dynamic therapist. So what a wonderful experience. You know, can wilderness therapy specifically? Because you have a unique perspective, both from your own personal, you know, story and history, but also from your professional kind of movement up through the system to become a therapist. What attracts you to wilderness therapy specifically, and how do you think this model differs from other kinds of interventions in the field?
Yeah, I think this is something I've really considered a lot for many years now, and trying to come up with what feels like an accurate answer for me at least. And some of the things that I've come to in particular are sort of that idea that I talked about just briefly earlier, which is we disconnect in order to connect. Like, we're getting rid of technology. We're out there in a therapeutic milieu with, you know, bare essentials to some degree. And I think that sort of development, work towards development of understanding who I am, where I've come from, you know, where I want to head, and then how do I navigate those things interpersonally and learn to communicate. I think there's such a focus that wilderness seems to do, and in particular what we're doing out there in the field, on these more practical and deep skills in some ways that sort of transcend what I would characterize as some of the basics of, you know, substance use, addiction, kind of coping skills, you know, like, of course, going to meetings, getting sponsors, working programs of recovery, often 12 steps are amazing things to be doing. But we're also looking at, right, like the childhood and development and what is happening for folks, you know, when they're really small, that's impacting their life later on. And I think the setting itself is one that we have, it more just seems to come up, Brad. I think back to some of my experiences in more kind of traditional residential programs. And in some ways, it kind of felt like a vacation sometimes. And there's something about just being outside, the sort of physical aspect of things that challenges us in a way that, you know, that helps get us to a place of more authentic kind of rawness, is how I guess I would describe it. But I think that's a huge part of it. I think a lot of times I say that, you know, the setting does a lot of the work in some ways to get us to a point where we're able to have some more impactful conversations about what it's been like to be us. So I think that's a huge part of it.
I always tell therapists that, like, it's really tempting to take a lot of credit for how dynamic the work goes with clients in our program, when we have to remember that our co-therapist, Wilderness Primitive Living, does so much, like you said, so much comes up, and it becomes such a dynamic experience to really participate in, to watch and to be a witness to. Tell us a little bit about your approach, Ken, your approach in the field, your style.
Sure. Yeah. So I think the way I would describe it is, you know, in going back to this idea of mentorship, right? You know, I think working with Griff really helped open my eyes to different styles that therapists can have, right? And to me, it's such a balance of course, science, absolutely, but also there's sort of an art to therapy. I think that's not exactly talked about as often as I would have expected, and sort of balancing the science of it with the art of it. And so how that plays out for me stylistically is, you know, I'm working with young men, you know, typically 17 to 30, that are struggling with addiction. And one of the things that is across the board, something they talk about, is feeling alone, feeling isolated, feeling disconnected from, and feeling like they're out of place, right? This has been something they've felt for a long time, typically. So knowing that's shaped a lot of the way that I try to be with my clients. And it's something I experienced, right? And so I would say I'm a relational therapist, which I know is a word that gets thrown out a lot. I like to, you know, I role model for them and use my own experience at times. And I think that's not always, that's not always taught as something that, that happens in a, you know, therapeutic relationship. But I think that I've had some profound experiences where we're able to talk about, you know, our stories and use that as a tool. So I like to use the relationship. I believe that the relationship in and of itself is one of the most important factors for healing. And that we're either moving towards connection or disconnection. This is part of kind of, there's a theory called relational cultural theory, which I was introduced to in grad school that resonated a lot with me because of mostly the language I think they used around connection and disconnection. And so I think that's important. I'm obviously, when you're talking about what my style is or my approach, I'm informed by attachment theory. And I think that's something that, you know, with your mentorship as well, right? We know that the childhood period in particular has a huge impact on how things are for us down the line later in life. And so paying attention to that is of utmost importance. And then I also think that, you know, I'm trained in somatic and attachment focused EMDR, and I think it's a great modality, a tool for treating trauma in the field, especially because it's not a traditional talk therapy, right? And sometimes the clients that I'm working with that have had traumatic experiences or are really struggling from negative core beliefs, it becomes difficult at times for them to put words to it, or sometimes the words, they're not quite to a stage where they're ready to put words to it. And so we're going in and accessing more of a memory place without having to do all of the kind of initial talking. And I think that's been disarming for some of the clients that I've worked with.
So you mentioned the type of client that you work with. Tell us a little bit about more about what is a Ken client, and what are the issues that they're typically struggling with?
So to elaborate on it, I think a Ken client is typically male, between the ages of, I'd say 17 and 30 or so. A Ken client is struggling with problematic substance use and or addiction, and also a lot of varying underlying issues, right? So ones that I see most commonly are anxiety is probably the predominant one, depression, ADHD, some trauma, as we discussed as well. And I think going, the kids that I'm working with are often sensitive, bright. They have struggled, you know, sometimes maintaining jobs, or have had issues related to commitment to school, or have struggled academically at times. Sometimes in college, sometimes in high school, combination of both. And really a Ken client, I think, is defined by, you know, seeking solutions to internal problems through substances, or sometimes problematic and repetitive behaviors. And so that to me is kind of the hallmark of someone that I would work with. But oftentimes bright and verbal and appreciates processing, but really stuck. And sometimes a lot of treatment, a variety of different treatment prior to coming to us. And that's a client I appreciate working with for sure. Because as I've said in my own story, right, we're looking to have a different kind of opportunity here than we've had in the past. And I really believe that we're able to do that with the clients that we work with. So that I love working with clients that have been to treatment a few times as well.
You know, that reminds me, I remember three things about that first session that we had together, which seems in some ways like a decade ago, and in some ways seems like, you know, a few months ago to me. It's so surreal. I remember your beard. I remember our mutual love of baseball. I may have been wearing an Angels hat, and you're a Giants fan.
You were, yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember just hopelessness, like that this wasn't going to work because you've tried other things and it wasn't going to work again. And so when you talk about who you work with, I imagine that part of what you can relate to them in them is because they are bright, because some of them have had multiple treatment attempts, you can relate to that hopelessness that they feel.
Absolutely. There's when you and I met, I remember that day very vividly still. And there, Griff often would describe it as I looked kind of gray almost. Like there was a sort of lifelessness there. And I think, you know, I was at a point in my life where I had struggled with, you know, what I would characterize as a pretty late stage addiction. And there weren't a lot of consequences left. And, you know, my health was suffering. And not all the clients that I work with are at that point. Luckily, we're doing more earlier intervention, which is amazing. And so, but there was a distinct sense of hopelessness, right? What could possibly work for me? So much shame too at the time around what is wrong with me that I can't change. I've seen other people make changes and yet here I am again, right? And so I think that was, there was such a shift in I would say, you know, somewhere between 30 and 90 days to not, no more hopelessness, but also sort of an empowerment that things can be different for me. I think it seems like a subtle thing, right? Like just changing that belief, but it has really amazing impacts. I think when you look at, I can do this and I can make changes and sure, it's going to be hard and sometimes it's going to suck and not every day is going to be, you know, amazing, but the days aren't going to be like they used to be either. And some of that to me, and I think that is such a relief for a lot of the people that I work with.
I really love that. I don't think people who maybe haven't been through it understand that feeling of hopelessness and how really the early stages of treatment, that's all we're trying to do is find that spark of hope and to fan it into a flame. And of course, watching where you've been to where you are now has been, again, an honor to witness. Let me ask the question about addiction. There aren't enough, you know, there are never too many definitions of addiction. I love everybody's idea about it. And part of it, because it's so personal. And it's so hard to explain because it is so personal. But as a therapist and somebody in recovery, how do you conceptualize addiction? What is it? What does that word mean to you when you hear it?
The word to me has a sort of the definition that we think of. I mean, when I think of addiction and just if we Google the term or we look in some textbooks, right, the sort of the inability to stop some kind of problematic behavior or substance despite adverse consequences is one place that people start. The way that I try to look at addiction is almost more universal. And I've really gravitated towards that lately. And the way I would describe it is, and it actually reminds me of something I think I saw on your social media actually lately. And I don't remember exactly what you said about it, but the idea is that at times we're all looking outside of ourselves for something to sort of mend or fix the wound that we have internally. And oftentimes that looks like substances, right? It can look like relationships. It can be different kinds of behaviors, you know, processed stuff, food, shopping, you know, overworking, underworking. And so one of the ways that I think about addiction now is not so much about, well, we have an addict versus not an addict, but we have this kind of universal experience that I think that we all participate in to some degree, depending on where we're at. And so I think sometimes that can be, you know, a different kind of approach for the clients that I work with. And it plays into this idea that, you know, we talk about a lot, I think, as a company, that, you know, we're all on a path of some kind. We're all doing our own work, right? I don't necessarily have all the answers. And I'm a work in progress too. And some days, you know, I struggle more than others. I don't use or drink, but I have good days and I have some days that aren't quite as good. And that's okay, right? And so to me, addiction, when we frame it that way, I think it makes it more palatable in some ways for the clients I work with to kind of address it and take a look at it, right? Rather than it being about the therapist saying, you're an addict, which is not necessarily something I would just tell someone, but it becomes an entry point into having real conversations about the ways that we disconnect and go outside of ourselves to change the way we feel internally.
It reminds me, I used to do this parent meeting because we would have regular field visits that were kind of scheduled. So I would do this parent meeting for years with parents. And during the course of the 3-hour discussion lecture, there was one question I would ask that I would say, what are things that we do? What are things that we do to escape our discomfort, our pain, our anxiety, and our stress? And, you know, people would talk about substances. They would talk about sex. They would talk about risky behaviors. They would list virtually every behavior under the sun. The one thing in doing this meeting for over 5 years, hundreds of times, that no parent ever said was workaholism. Even though I had, right, had said that it was a we question, you know, what do we do? Nobody ever said work because they could not think about their children, and no parent has ever accused their child of being a workaholic, I used to say and joke. But it just reminds me of your answer to the question about the universality of escape. The universality, right, of wanting to numb ourselves and distract ourselves from that empty place, that wounded place inside. Which brings me to the next question of recovery. You know, I think this can be interesting for parents because oftentimes people think of it in a very simplistic way. So can you talk for a moment about what your idea of recovery is? How would you explain and introduce that to listeners?
So to me, the starting point of it is that there's a distinct difference in my mind between abstinence and recovery, right? And so abstinence to me is abstaining from using substances, for example. That would be one form. And it's sort of a, you know, the thing about abstinence is you're simply just taking something away. I'm not doing something, right? But in recovery to me is so much more about I'm going to be doing all of these other things and being engaged in my own personal growth. And so I think it's sort of an umbrella term for my process moving forward. And to me, being in recovery means a willingness and an openness to exploring what my work is and not just exploring it, but then engaging in it. So I think fundamentally, you know, that can be working a 12-step process. I think, you know, depending on what kind of program, it could also be other programs, right? It could be like working refuge or refuge recovery or some other kinds of programs, but it really to me is characterized by an openness and willingness to continue doing our work. And I like what, you know, I remember Griff used to say a lot, we want recovery to be an event and not a process,
right?
And that to me is sort of at the crux of it, which is, I think a lot of times we want to just see the light and make a different decision. And I can tell you genuinely, Brad, there were so many times where I swore it off and I said, I've seen the light. I'm going to stop. I mean, all of my early 20s were moments of that where I said, I know I need to do this differently. And I'm committed to doing it. And I continued to struggle. And one of the reasons I continued to struggle was because it wasn't an event. Right. I needed much more. I needed help. I needed community. I needed kind of brothers and sisters that were able to hold me when I couldn't hold myself. And so I think that to me is a recovering process. To me, the most important part of a recovery process is developing our community and finding our people, so to speak. I think my life really changed dramatically when I found a group of men and some women as well that were able to show up for me in a way that I had not experienced before. And that really changed everything.
I love it. You've actually given me some ideas. You've given me some thoughts and ideas with clients that really wouldn't identify with even a process addiction, you know, but they're all talking about not wanting to do something, right? Right. Not wanting to lash out at a family member or not wanting to respond to their anxiety. So that idea about recovery being more about something that you do rather than just not doing something is I think a great, great lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. And adding to that, you know, finally, I would just kind of end with this, which is, as we've discussed, the clients that I work with, they come in hopeless, oftentimes feeling really broken, disconnected, and there's so much guilt and shame. And I suppose the message I want to relay is just essentially that these things can change. It's not permanent or static, and that there is hope in this. And sometimes I think that message is, while it seems so simple and is really an important one to continue to reiterate, that there is hope in this, in seemingly hopeless situations. So,
you know, I think that your story, it's one of the gifts of your story. It offers hope to your clients, but I think it could offer hope to parents who, because I think parents feel a very, very similar kind of hopelessness. So thank you for being willing to share your story with all of us. Before we conclude, we want to hear a little bit about your personality, your passions, your interests, your hobbies. What do you do for fun outside of work?
Sure. Yeah. So I've always been kind of a board guy, B-O-A-R-D. I grew up as a skateboarder. I think I snowboarder, and I think I was really attracted to that in some ways because of my story also, right? Feeling kind of different than, I found some friends that also felt like they were kind of different. That's always been a part of things. Not that it's necessarily counterculture or anything these days, but I have stuck by kind of my love for skateboarding and snowboarding and continue to do those things. I also, after I got into recovery, really picked up surfing, and I love to surf. And in Bend, we actually have a wave in the river, and I spend a lot of time surfing down at that wave in the Deschutes River, and that's a huge passion of mine. I love being outside now and doing those kinds of physical activities. I'm still, you know, kind of a newer therapist. And one of the things that I enjoy doing is just trying to learn and spend time learning this work and absorbing more information. And that's a big passion of mine to continue to define kind of who I am in this role. And I'm still obviously active in 12-step communities and, even as a therapist, trying to be, you know, a sponsor and showing up and doing service for other struggling addicts and alcoholics. That's a big part of my life as well. And so I like to be outside. I like to continue to do my own work, go to therapy, go to AA. And yeah.
Thanks, Ken. And I don't know that I can add anything to what I've already stated. Just a gratitude for being able to watch your journey, to witness your journey from that first day in the wilderness to where you are today has been a pure joy and an inspiration to me. Even today, just listening to your story again, it gives me an inspiration for things in my life that I'm struggling with. And I'm sure that the families and clients that you work with feel the same kind of thing. So thank you so much. Thank you for being on our team, for bringing yourself to this work, and for all that you do, for all that you serve. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much, Brad. It's really an amazing opportunity, and look forward to continue working with you and with all the families and clients I work with. And it's really just an honor to be able to show up for people. And yeah, so thank you.
All right, folks, thanks for joining us in our continued series about learning about our Evoke therapy program staff and therapists. And so join us next time. And as always, thank you for and on behalf of the children, the loved ones in your life, and for the work that you're doing. Thank you. I thank you for them. Take care. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.